Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome to the Damage Report. Big stuff going on in the lead up to the show. We'll get back to that during the breaks. Jer Jackson's here. Of course he is. It's Wednesday.
That's right. It's Jer Wednesdays. Hey, behind the scenes, you know who wasn't here? No, we were here on time.
This is definitely what we need to be talking about right now. Anyway, the show is here. That's what's important. We'll have a couple of guests for you a little bit later on. We're gonna be joined. We talked last week about this interesting study linking fragile masculinity to support for Donald Trump that was profiled in the Washington Post. So we have one of the researchers who produced this research gonna be joining the show to break it down, let us know what it means. Also, big developments in Jeffrey Epstein and his ongoing legal. Well, I guess struggles is the word you use, but he doesn't seem to be struggling very much with it. It seems to be going quite well for him. Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox, will be joining us in the second half of the show to break that down. Before that, though, I mean, we've got this major power grab in Wisconsin we're going to be talking about. The sentencing document for Mike Flynn was released late last night. Lots to get to.
Can I say my favorite story today?
I'm curious.
I hope we do get to it. I hope it didn't switch up or anything on me. The way people speak to minorities.
If we do have that.
Based off of their potential internal biases and what they think they're really doing to help the situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's an age-old problem that every minority has noticed. Trust me, we know.
Okay. Well, we're going to fight about that maybe. No, probably not. But in the last segment of the show, I think we'll be talking about that. So look forward to that. But first, let's jump into some domestic news. We've been talking recently about Wisconsin, where in this midterm election, the Democratic governor candidate was elected, also attorney general. And so it looks like people in Wisconsin really support the Democrats. And now the Democrats will have power, except that they won't. Because as happened in North Carolina just a couple of years ago, the Republicans who still control the state legislature and still technically have a Republican governor for a little bit longer are passing a number of different laws to handicap the incoming new Democratic politicians. We'd been talking about that. It has actually happened now. They passed that bill. The GOP power grab in Wisconsin is now complete. Let's talk about some of the things that they did. One part of the package would prohibit municipalities from allowing more than 2 weeks of early voting. And the weird thing is, in America, you can cut down the amount of time people have to vote, and you don't even have to debate it. You don't have to answer for it. Mm-hmm. You can just pass a bill that says, I don't want people to vote. I don't want it to be easy. I want it to be very, very difficult. I want as few people as possible to vote. And that presumably won't hurt them in future elections. They won't have to, there won't be ads attacking them.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, democracy is this interesting optional thing that we have in America.
It's weird.
Sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't.
And it's totally based upon whoever you think is your team. So again, like there's this perception because of the previous ways that things have always done with elections, they know that their voting bloc won't necessarily benefit from this. Mm-hmm. But again, it has to be an approach in the way that it attack. Because attack ads just go to them saying, hey, that team is attacking my team. I hate that team. So no matter what they're saying, they must be lying or they must be doing something that would hurt me.
Yeah.
Seeing it's from people from, say, in this case, the Republican side. The approach, I think, and I don't know if it's catering too much to idiots, but the approach can then be, hey, you know what they're doing to you, Republican voters? Mm-hmm. They're keeping you from voting. Like, don't even say it like there's a, and they're coming after, you know, if the attack ads come that way, which those don't even come. First of all, the attack ads don't even happen. But if you at least go with the, hey, this is what they're doing to you, the narrative has to become these Republican officials, representatives, don't actually represent even you because they still think they're being represented somehow.
Yeah.
And I don't know how, well, I do know how because we're not letting people know how much they're actually not being represented. Everyone should have the ability to vote. It's not a Democrat. Oh, yeah, we want our liberals to come out and vote, not the Republicans. Mm. No one ever says that.
Well, and hopefully people should care about that.
Yeah.
One of the reasons you don't have the ads is, as incensed as we might get about these sorts of things, or you know, voter ID and all these different measures, voter suppression, voter purges, all that, it seems like the vast majority of people in America are like, eh.
Totally.
Eh, what's... Yeah, American democracy, that's cool. Maybe someday I'll vote, don't really care. Maybe it'll be really hard, maybe it won't. People are incredibly blasé about the most important thing that allows them to have an effect on everything else in this country politically. What ends up happening, you have to have those voting rights and people just don't prioritize them.
You know why old folks love to vote? because when they were growing up, it was drilled into their heads. This is the only control. This is the main level of control you have on your life and your world. Vote, 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 vote. And there were so many people who didn't have the ability or right to vote that those folks, there's old black folks, they love to vote because they remember when they couldn't.
Yeah.
So we don't have that the historical nature in our brains anymore about it. So it needs to be said over and over and over again. If someone comes out and you know this is your pet project, there's a voting holiday and they won't stop saying we need a voting holiday, a voting holiday, a voting holiday, a voting holiday, we won't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if that was in that first bill, the voting rights bill that the Democrats talked about. I will check to make sure. I'm not 100% sure. Let's talk about what else is in this power grab that they passed. Other provisions would give the legislature full control of a state economic development agency, block the governor's ability to write regulations, and allow the legislature to hire its own lawyers to file lawsuits on behalf of the state. All of these things are things that they honestly believe that the legislature should be in control of, and they just didn't think of it during the many years that they had a Republican governor. It's just, I guess he just happened to have that power for a little while. Obviously, Governor Evers, Tony Evers, the incoming Democrat who won recently, is going to challenge this. He says, we will actively be looking at either to litigate or do whatever else in our power to make sure the people of Wisconsin are represented at the table. So good luck to him in that. In North Carolina, they were actually successful, thankfully, the Democrats, in stopping some of this. But this can't be a thing that Tony Evers is doing, or the Wisconsin Democratic Party is doing, or even Wisconsin is doing. As a country, we need to fight back against this. Whether your interest is just in stopping future voter suppression acts and things like that, or whether you philosophically are opposed to effectively making democracy irrelevant. You gerrymander the hell out of these things. You set up things like, you know, obviously the Electoral College, the Senate itself. You make it so that you do not effectively need to win elections anymore.
Right.
That is what the Republicans have staked out as their political governing strategy going forward. Lose elections, keep power. Lose elections massively, keep super majorities in the state legislatures. That is what they're doing. We are either going to bow down to it or we're going to fight back.
I don't know what else Tony Evers has been saying, but that one line, I know there's more, but I feel like there needs to be a level of anger. Fine, let them call you mad. Let them say that you're a sore winner. I don't know what is it. How can they pose your anger towards you stripping power from a winning candidate for governor of a state?
Yeah.
So if you come in strong again, maybe he's saying other things. I saw one thing where he said, frankly, the entire thing is a hot mess. Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, yeah. But when saying, we're going to look into some things. I can remember the quote exactly. We're going to look into some things and decide what we can do legislatively or whatever he said.
Yeah, or a court challenge, which is most likely how this will go.
Sure. But you know what? Continue to tell the public this is messed up. Mm-hmm. They're anti-American. This is unpatriotic thing to do. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what they're up to. This is what the governor, why we just kicked him out.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't love America.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, people have been talking about, like, it's something that in the past we haven't really had to think about. But lame duck sessions are kind of interesting. It's like effectively, if you have enough of a wave election, like, the people have been pretty clear that they don't support you. But you have this last chance to shape things in your favor. And just imagine, like, if through all of this conversation, you still think this isn't a big deal, imagine if you heard this was happening in another country, that someone had won and then they just drastically stripped their powers at the last moment. Like, would you actually think, that is a strong functioning democracy in that other country? I don't think that you would.
We used to be able to point out and say we don't do things like that.
Exactly. We do, unfortunately. And thankfully, they fought back in a couple of instances. Hopefully, it will succeed in Wisconsin as well, the fighting back. Okay. Throughout the week, we've been checking in on the process where these new incoming freshmen, congressmen and women, what are they actually doing before they get into office? And thanks to people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we have a lot more access and information in that process. And also how some of them, this new fresh blood, is going to be changing things a little bit. And so you're seeing down there in that lower third, talk about intern pay. Interns around the country are obviously paid horribly a lot of the time. That has been true generally in DC as well, despite the fact that DC is a very expensive place. And this conversation was going on Twitter and yesterday, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responded to a message from Stephen Dennis talking about lawmakers that were, you can see down on the bottom, lawmakers seeking unpaid interns, despite the fact that there's no apartments under $1,000 a month on Capitol Hill listed on apartments.com. And so she pointed out, obviously, there's some irony there, where they're very concerned about paying for things when it comes to stuff like Medicare for All. But when it comes to the actual people writing these bills, reviewing these bills, making it so that our government actually functions on a day-to-day basis, eh, they'll find some money somewhere, don't worry about it. And so after that, people asked, are people like Alexandria and others going to change this policy? And Jeff Stein of the Washington Post confirms that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will be paying her interns at least $15 an hour. To put it in perspective, a 2017 study shows that only 8% of House Republicans and 4% of House Democrats pay their interns at all.
So, a number that people wouldn't have thought. First off, 8 is too low in the first place as far as the Republicans do. But Democrats, just in half of that number.
Yeah, I mean, both are terrible.
It's terrible. So you know what else this does also? In order for someone to be able to be an unpaid intern and work for a certain full time a lot of times, which they have to do, they have to have money coming from somewhere. I don't care if the apartments aren't under $1,000. Hey, you can say there's no apartments listed in the D.C. area that are under $200 a month. You know why? Because zero is also less than $200 a month. Mm-hmm. So it's weird. If you pay them nothing, they can't afford anything. It's weird that the $1,000 was the number. Why is that even a number?
Well, they can't afford
anything
unless
they have some money or they're rich.
And where might they have, exactly,
parents.
They come from a rich
family.
So
it continues to say, hey, Congressman, Senator, whoever, hire my kid. Because, we have a relationship. It continues that same corona relationship that we've always had.
Yeah, you look at the greatest example, obviously, is when, Paul Ryan will pose in front of all of the interns for the Republican Party. And it's like, they all look kind of similar. Why is it that you get certain types of people? Yes, in that example, it's going to be an ideological thing, but whatever. But in general, this is a way, without saying it, that you weed out certain type of people, whether intentionally or not. If you are poor and or don't live in that area, you are not going to be able to be an intern if you're getting paid nothing. And so you will get people who have rich families. Maybe they've struck it rich themselves. I'm imagining at that age, that's probably not going to be the case. Or that happen to live in the DC area, in which case they're living in the bubble as well. So credit to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for changing this, making it possible for a more diverse representative sample of people, including people, by the way, from her district in New York to actually be able to be interns.
Weird how that
how
works.
Would those people, under Joe Crowley, I don't know whether he paid his interns, maybe he's part of the 4%. How would anyone from his district be an intern in DC if you're paying them $0 an hour? It's impossible. What are they doing, a GoFundMe? It can't actually happen. So this is a good, necessary change. Hopefully her putting pressure on this will put pressure on others to do the same.
Can I call out one thing? I know we're up against it. Chuck Schumer had, again, Democrat, had an ad out for an unpaid press intern. The posting he put out said, seeks full-time unpaid interns in D.C. starting in late December or early January. Part-time interns will be considered, but candidates with full-time availability will be given preference. Yeah, we need you to work more. It's preferable that the candidate can continue to work through the fall and into May. Unpaid from the end of this year up and through May. We're going to give you that. And then when they ask, hey, you're not going to pay anybody for this whole time working for Chuck Schumer, one of the biggest names in all of politicians right now. A spokesman said, we posted that erroneously. Eligible interns would get stipends in January of maybe $10 to $15. So what happens from December to January?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yeah. January, and then after January on into May. How are we paying rent? How are you eating? Sorry, I had to point out how
erroneously
crazy that was.
Erroneously.
And we just made that mistake.
Sure. Yeah, you know. We erroneously were caught posting that. Okay. We're going to take our first break. When we come back, joined by an awesome guest breaking down some of the research, fascinating stuff having to do with support for Donald Trump after this. Last week on an episode of The Damage Report, we talked about a very interesting study profiled in The Washington Post having to do with men who are uncertain in their masculinity and support for Donald Trump. So I'm very excited now to welcome to The Damage Report Eric Knowles, social psychologist at NYU, lead researcher on that study. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Very glad to have you here. So for those who might not have seen our first video on the topic, what sort of study were you doing? What were you looking into?
Well, we were looking into a phenomenon that we call fragile masculinity, which is when men feel anxious that they aren't living up to whatever prevailing ideals or standards of manhood they have in their environment. So meeting these standards will often involve proving your strength and virility, being dominant and tough, and really importantly, avoiding even the hint of femininity. And we were really interested in whether this has political ramifications in the current moment.
So how did you look into that? And what were your findings when it comes to support for an example of a man who at least asserts to be very high in all these different measures when it comes to being a real man, Donald Trump?
Right. So the way we measured this, because we didn't think we could just straightforwardly poll men about their insecurities. So we used a publicly accessible tool called Google Trends that allows you to compare the popularity of different Google search terms in different regions of the country. And based on our sort of theorizing, we thought searches for topics like erectile dysfunction or hair loss or testosterone or Viagra might tend to be more popular in areas where men are experiencing a sense of fragile masculinity. And what we did was we used search volumes in different areas for these terms to predict how well Donald Trump did and how well more recently Republican House candidates did in actual elections in those areas.
And I want to make sure that people understand. So what you found, you did control, you looked at other elections that this was not, I mean, you found obviously greater support for Donald Trump, but this wasn't just a Republican thing, right? Or just a conservative thing.
No, and we didn't really know what to expect in that sense. What we found was that if you look back retrospectively and try to predict how well Mitt Romney did, how well John McCain did before that using these search terms, you don't see any effect. But when it comes to Trump, we see a really robust correlation between the popularity of these search terms in a region and how well Donald Trump did in that region. And importantly, we're able to control or adjust for other factors like the average age of the men in that region, or the ethnic makeup of men in the region, or the rates of college education in the region. So we controlled for a lot of other factors to try to isolate what we think is a really interesting effect.
Okay, so very interesting study. I would like to learn more about fragile masculinity for those in our audience. I'd like them to learn as well. So I am curious, in other work around this topic, we know now, apparently, it can predict some support, or at least there's evidence that it can predict some support for Donald Trump. Are men who are feeling this, are they more likely to support certain types of government policies or hold certain political or ideological values?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some great research in other labs. Like there's a sociologist, Rob Willer at Stanford, who's taken an experimental approach to this and actually exposed men to masculinity threats, and found that when men in his studies are exposed to masculinity threats, they will embrace kind of more bellicose foreign policy attitudes. He found when the study was run, for instance, that it increased support for the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. It seems across a lot of studies, both experiments and survey type studies, to lead embracing more sort of right-wing, more kind of authoritarian policy attitudes and foreign policy of a kind of dominant nature.
Okay, I can certainly understand the connection there. Do we, at this point, do you know, Are some men just fragile in their masculinity and others aren't? It's sort of a free-flowing, random thing? Or do we have some idea of what can cause certain men or groups of men to begin to feel this way?
I mean, that's a really great question. I don't think it's just a random thing. I think that it's, I think when you get down to it, it's cultural. That some men are exposed to really stringent and almost unattainable ideals of what it means to be a man. And it's almost inevitable that men who exist in that kind of cultural setting are going to be more likely to feel insecure about how well they're doing because the standards are so high and so inflexible. And I want to be really clear that I don't think that men in areas of the country where these searches are popular are intrinsically any different from any men anywhere else. They're just normal men who are sort of contending with these really unattainable ideals of manhood. And just really quick, one thing we did find to your question is that in areas with very high unemployment rates, you see popularity of these fragile masculinity search terms are higher. So we think that's one way in which it's not just the, as you say, the random flow. It's men who are trying to get by in areas where they've suffered job losses, closure of their sort of traditional industries that they work in, manufacturing, mining. Okay. It's probably not a coincidence that this sense of insecurity is highest in those areas.
Okay, and potentially suggesting for some politicians who might want to fight back against this, some measures they could take. I have one more quick question for you. I apologize if this seems like an aside, but I spend a lot of time on the internet, and so I'm just curious. I have noticed that one of the big insults coming from right wingers over the past few years has been cuck. It's become a thing that's very common. In your work, is there any reason to believe that this might be an expression less of them identifying less masculine men than them feeling less masculine themselves?
That people who use that epithet are feeling less masculine themselves? I think there's a connection. Obviously, that comes out of the sort of more racially tinged right wing. But I've been called that very word since the article came out more than once, and a lot of other things for that matter.
Yeah.
But I absolutely think that it's of a piece.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, and thank you for being willing to do this sort of research, knowing that it is an online minefield that you're entering into. So thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Eric Knoll, social psychologist at New York University. Thank you again. We here at The Damage Report are going to take a break. When we come back, lots more news to get to. In just a moment, we're going to talk about the special counsel's sentencing guidelines memo for Michael Flynn. But in the next block, you're going to want to stick around. Senior politics reporter for Vox, Jane Costin, is going to be joining us, breaking down the latest and some of the history, in fact, on the Jeffrey Epstein continuing scandal. It is some dark, dark stuff, so you're not going to want to miss that. But first, Mike Flynn. Throughout yesterday, we knew that the special counsel's office would be dropping a sentencing guidelines memo for Mike Flynn. Remember Mike Flynn? He hasn't been in the news recently, but there's so many people. You just forget, you lose people in this scandal. But yeah, he lied to the FBI. He was one of those. And we've been wondering, his sentencing has been postponed, I believe, 4 times by Robert Mueller. Despite the fact that the lie that he told that got him in trouble was near 2 years ago at this point, and we've known about it for the vast majority of that time. So what has been going on during that time? Well, we now have some information coming from the sentencing memo. So first of all, the sort of the headline version of this is that the special counsel praises Flynn's assistance as substantial, writing that a sentence that does not impose a term of incarceration for him would be appropriate and warranted. So effectively, based on the help that he has provided to the investigation, Mueller would be fine with him getting no jail time whatsoever, or if any, very little. And he praised both the assistants. He also said you need to take into account his military service and things like that. That is a little bit more questionable, I guess, considering the nature of the crime. They think that there's some connection between those two things. I don't think personally your service matters if you've been breaking the law, but I guess Mueller knows more about the law than I do.
I'll let you finish. But in my opinion, your service and your knowledge of how things work actually factors in more in your desire to go ahead and flip and do it that way. And you know more about exactly how you're committing treason.
And it's interesting, in that same section he said, But senior government officials need to be held to the highest standards. He also pointed out we need to take into account his military service and government service. And he pointed out which none of the other people having been charged can sort of point to. So sort of like, I guess, a little bit of slamming them at the same time. So let's talk about what has he been assisting on? What can we learn from this memo? They say that his early cooperation was particularly valuable because he was one of the few people with long-term and firsthand insight regarding events and issues under investigation by the SCO. So he has more information over a longer period of time on some aspects of this than anyone else. I'm sure in other areas, Michael Cohen probably has more information, but Mike Flynn has been around for a long time. They also say that his assistance might have led others to be more helpful to the special counsel. So the information that they got wasn't just from him, but it might have been because of him, in fact. Now, the interesting stuff is not what is in this document, it's what's not in this document. So let's go now to the first section. This is a description of the three different investigations that Michael Flynn was actually helping with. You're seeing immediately redacted things. So first of all, there is, if you're scanning the top line, he helped with a criminal investigation, which is then redacted. We don't know what that criminal investigation is. Then the special counsel's office investigation into any potential links between Russian government officials and the campaign of Donald Trump. That section, not redacted. And then the third, an entire investigation is redacted. But it's redacted in an interesting way considering the format of the paragraph up until that point. Not only are the details of that investigation redacted, but even what sort of investigation it is redacted. So in the first section, it identifies it as a criminal investigation that we then don't have any details for. For the third one, we don't know if it's a criminal investigation or otherwise. And what would it take for that identifier to need to be redacted? Why couldn't we know that? How secret does a thing need to be that you can't even say if it's a civil thing, a criminal thing, a thing having to do with Russia or not?
So they can't, I mean, that could be virtually anything.
Right,
I'm nowhere a legal expert. I wonder if it's allowing a certain level of communication and coordination with how you're going to defend in a legal, I mean, a criminal versus just like a, I guess, a lesser investigation. Which I wouldn't know why that had to be hidden anyway, especially if you already are willing to point out that the first, as you said, is a criminal investigation that he assisted in. But he apparently knows a lot of information. I always felt like he and Manafort, because of their work with transition and also during the campaign, knew the most. And we saw the way that Flynn has cooperated since pretty early on, just the way Manafort said he would, but then didn't, and now is under more fire because of it. So it's the walls appear to be closing, and we see who's actually cooperating more than others because of the information they do have.
Yeah, and he apparently, over the course of the nearly 2 years, has sat for 19 different interviews with Mueller and the team. That is a, I mean, what did you not find out by the 16th interview that you needed to then go back to? And look, that's not the case with some of the other people that have had deals with Robert Mueller. They didn't do 19 interviews, but Michael Flynn apparently did know quite a bit. I want to return to that third investigation, though, because to some extent I was exaggerating, saying that we don't know anything about it. Because, in fact, later on in the document, there are actually a couple of paragraphs about that investigation. So let's bring this up, and you'll see the first section there. Oh, wait, it's all redacted, actually. So it is technically there. There is a description that some people who got this memo will have seen, but the entire thing is redacted. I don't know what to make of that. Like, I will say this, going into the sentencing memo, I didn't really particularly care about Michael Flynn. Look, the fact that his lie to the FBI had to do with communications about sanctions, especially considering what we found out recently about the Trump Tower Moscow project, that is obviously relevant. But it takes at this point quite a bit for me to get sort of stirred up or interested in this stuff. But redacting multiple paragraphs about an investigation that we might never have heard of before, that I think certainly crosses that bar.
The guy that's acting as a foreign agent worked with them talking about the meeting with Junior and everyone, talked about the potential sanctions and how they didn't want certain things to be voted on. How they didn't want to have certain escalations in over sanctions with Russia. Also, I think the third leg of it had to do with the way the UN was going to vote about how Israel wanted certain things happening in Palestine with that conflict. So there's multiple levels in which they were communicating, and he was basically the liaison, the in-between guy, to talk about all this stuff. So when you already say he's been lying, the next step becomes, why was he lying? And then the why becomes an extension about everything else that was happening. Hence that third page of black bars.
Yeah, we still don't know why he would have lied. As has been pointed out by many people, the lie about the communications exposed him to far greater penalties than simply admitting it. It was technically a violation of the Logan Act, but that has never been prosecuted before. It is a bizarre thing to lie. And to then pretend that it's an independent lie, that it does not exist in this web of similar lies, that is bizarre as well.
It connects to way too many. Also, KT McFarland, who also worked with the, closely with the administration, also, she had to change her testimony based off what Flynn then said he was lying about. She goes, oh, yeah, that's right, me too. I was lying too. Can I say that I forgot the truth?
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on, man.
Which maybe. And so she's been let off since the very beginning there. Yeah. I had been waiting to see this morning what Donald Trump would say about this. He has shown great restraint up until this point. Perhaps tomorrow morning we'll get some sort of tweet storm. I have seen the right wing reaction. It is the same as it has been to every development in this case, no matter how light, no matter how serious. People pleading guilty to multiple charges or being convicted. All of it's nonsense. All of it's a waste of time.
And Mueller's
sure
growing,
it is.
Their explanation, I believe, is I think one, they said Mueller's growing an extra couple horns, something like that.
Something like
that. Yeah, it was along those lines.
So look, perhaps some of this information will come out when the actual sentencing happens. This is simply a guideline to the judge who will do that sentencing. We still have some time to wait for that. Hopefully, we will eventually figure out what this third investigation is. The possibility remains that it's something minor. I don't know why you would black out the entire thing if that was the case, but I'm just going to put that out there as a possibility, trying to be super fair on this. That said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Jane Costa is going to be joining us. Jeffrey Epstein, what did he do? What penalties did he get? What has he avoided so far? And where do we go from here after this? Infamous money manager Jeffrey Epstein back in the news this week. Ongoing legal struggles having to do with his cult of sex trafficking, bizarre stuff, complex settlement reached this week. Very happy to be joined now on the show. Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox, to help break down all this. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. So look, Jeffrey Epstein is not someone that we've talked about very often on the show, and his legal struggles go back a number of years. You've written recently on Vox about it. Can you break down what exactly it is that he's alleged to have done and what penalties he's served up until this point for it?
So the best way to just explain this is as Joseph Ricari, who is the lead Palm Beach detective investigating Jeffrey Epstein in the early 2000s, called it a sexual pyramid scheme. So basically what Epstein would do is he would pay young women, and when I say young women, I mean girls around the age of 14, to come over to his home and give him massages, which then turned into sexual activity. And the girls who were not willing to do so, he would either throw them out of his house or be like, look, I'll give you money if you bring me another girl. So it, you know, at a certain point, we got to around 80 women who were identified of having being victims of Jeffrey Epstein. You know, one quote said that Courtney Wilde, who was among these girls, said that she recruited 70 or 80 girls for Epstein. He told me he wanted them as young as I could find them. He wanted as many girls as I could get them. It was never enough. And this is happening to like 13, 14-year-old girls. And this appears to have been something that Epstein, who he's now 65 years old, he's been described as, you'd use the term money manager, but it's interesting because a lot of people were, even in before any of these allegations came out, there's a great 2002 New York Magazine profile where it kept comparing him to the Wizard of Oz or to Jay Gatsby from The Great Gatsby, in that like no one was really sure how much money he actually has or what he actually does. But he basically collected a number of like famous friends to kind of protect him and shore him up. And those have included, you know, both Presidents Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, and former Harvard professor and now and famous attorney Alan Dershowitz, who was on his defense team during the 2005 investigation into Epstein's actions.
And so I'm glad that you brought that up. Very briefly on the Dershowitz. So while Epstein was getting all of these massages, Dershowitz apparently partook as well, correct?
So that's complicated, actually. Alan Dershowitz actually just wrote a letter to the Miami Herald saying, like, none of this is true. I absolutely was not involved in any of this. And, you know, he said that the person who made that accusation is lying and he would like her to make those accusations in court so that he could sue her. But and he said that, you know, he can produce dates and times to indicate that they, you know, they were not in the same place at the same time. But, you know, Alan Dershowitz is also the same person who in around 2006, 2007, when this lawsuit, the first investigations are going on, the FBI is looking into this. You know, he's the one who's trawling these girls' MySpace profiles to basically find ways to discredit them. And again, keep in mind, these girls, you know, Jeffrey Epstein largely went after girls who were in troubled situations, you know, and several of his victims eventually, you know, one girl later died of a heroin overdose. Wow. So, you know, he was looking, you know, this legal team is basically going after these girls to attempt to discredit them. While Epstein himself, you know, I want to read this quote. You know, it was a known quantity again that Jeffrey Epstein had a thing for young girls. And I want to read a quote from Vanity Fair columnist Michael Wolff, who described flying on Epstein's private plane in the 1990s and says that, you know, he was followed onto the plane by, how shall I say this, three teenage girls, not his daughters, who were model-like. And Wolff added, he has never been secretive about the girls. At one point when his troubles began, he was talking to me and said, what can I say? I like young girls. And I said, maybe you should say, I like young women.
Okay, very uncomfortable quotes there, especially for a guy who, as you pointed out, is now 65 years old. So I want to focus on a couple aspects that just shocked me as I guess I'd either forgotten, but back during the initial case, because we've had multiple sort of different legal strands going on. So first of all, what time in jail did he actually spend? Like for what you've described is some of the worst activity that I've ever seen. I mean, people have gone down for photographs or sleeping with one woman. Like he had dozens and dozens.
So he served, and I'm going to say, you know, 13 months in jail. But it's important to note that according to the Miami Herald, that jail term was spent in the private wing of a Palm Beach County jail. And he was granted work release to go to a comfortable office for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, despite the fact that technically Palm Beach Sheriff's Department prohibited work release for, you know, cases of sexual assault and abuse.
That is amazing.
So he basically, you know, I think a lot of people, because the deal that came up was made with, you know, a close counterpart of Donald Trump, and that is Alexandra Acosta.
Oh,
and
yes.
So he was the U.S. attorney in Miami and then was apparently floated to replace Sessions most recently, but now after the story, they've said, like, that's not going to really be an option. But he struck this deal with Jeffrey Epstein. And let's keep in mind that the FBI was investigating. They decided they were going to expand the investigation because they believed that they would be able to find hundreds more victims from across the country. And because Acosta signed, like, set this deal with Jeffrey Epstein, that never happened. And so we don't know how many victims there are. We don't know a lot about, you know, because of the facets of this deal that was made, we don't have a lot of details. And it's interesting because that seems to have happened again just this week with the settlement that was reached that kept a lot of these victims from telling their story on the stand.
And one of the parts of that I found unbelievable, and I don't even understand how it's legal, was part of the settlement protected any co-conspirators that had not been discovered at that point from being investigated. So not just we would find more victims potentially, but if more people had been participating in this, there would be no legal recourse in that deal, which seems unprecedented.
Right. It's a very strange case, and I think it's an incident that I'm really glad that it's starting to get more attention. All the props to go to the Miami Herald and their terrific reporting. And it seems as if there's been a lot of action being taken. Senator Ben Sasse sent letters to the Justice Department that he wants a full investigation into how this deal got made. But I really think that this is one of those moments in which you get the idea that, you know, when you have, you know, Jeffrey Epstein owns an island. He owns the single largest private residence in Manhattan. He is an extremely wealthy and powerful person. He gave $30 million to Harvard. He had, like, has a lot of powerful people around him because that was something he valued. But it appears that that accumulation of power was to be used as a bulwark against an investigation, and it worked.
Wow. Yeah, and so far, no justice, although perhaps in the future. Jane Costin, great work. Thank you for joining us and helping break that down. Very helpful.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, JR's favorite story of the day, how do white liberals act when speaking to non-whites? Some research, very interesting stuff, which we'll break down after this. Welcome back to What Remains of the Damage Report. Fascinating research coming out of Yale. I know JR is very excited about this. Take a look at this. This is a description. According to new research by Sidney Dupree at Yale, white liberals tend to downplay their own verbal competence at exchanges with racial minorities compared to how other white Americans act in such exchanges. So they did two studies, basically. They looked at speeches by politicians, both Democrat and Republican, to both minority audiences and non-minority audiences. And they found that the sorts of words that demonstrate competence, either speaking favorably about your own competence or expressing a complicated vocabulary, white liberals tend to not use that. But words that express warmth and familiarity and stuff like that, they do. And that this effect is only found amongst liberals. Now that's speeches, you might think, politician speeches. But they found that they did an experiment with regular people and they found it there too.
It's just the way things go. Okay, it's subconscious, obviously. So people think everyone has their racial biases and particulars and assumptions. So whether you're a conservative or liberal, a lot of folks, because just the nature of our country, don't interact with folks that they didn't grow up with or know naturally, unless you get to school or something. But a lot of times, we're a segregated country. That's the way it was based from the beginning. So we're still trying to get out of that. So when you don't grow up around certain folks, you don't understand them, and you worry that they're not going to understand you. So your assumption of what they're going to see as a connection is made up. So a lot of times it's like, yeah, you know, I keep hearing how black folks don't know anything. But you know what? I think they should know. I think they have the capability to know something. So you talk down.
That sounds good.
Yeah, so you speak down without thinking that they're actually lower than you, but it's somewhere in that process, it really is happening. An example, and with the part of the study talked about how Republicans, as far as speeches and presidential campaigns go, they didn't have much of a sample size because they just don't speak to minorities.
So, for Republicans, you're saying.
Yeah, that's one thing. But this example being Mitt Romney when he was running, I love this little piece. He was speaking to like this group of like tween black kids, and he goes, who wants whatever? He goes, who let the dogs out? Woo, woo. And he said, and it's like the
he said this in 1996, right?
So it's like in his first presidential run. Who let the dogs out? Woo, woo. And it's the funniest thing because they're, and then the kids went, what? It's, I can't generalize too much.
Who wants to move to Bel Air?
But the thing is, he was trying, right? He's going, I'm going to connect with these black kids. And you know what they listen to? The Baja Men. Is that who made that song?
I think it's the Baja Men, yeah.
Who let the dogs out? And they're gonna go, oh my God, he said woo woo. That's how that speaks to us.
And a kid in the background's like, whoop, there it is.
So a lot of folks recognize this discomfort and this very uncomfortable conversations. A lot of people that are trying to connect with us have, and they go, in the back of your brain, you're going, they don't know anything about me. And so the thing that Obama did well was he would speak without lowering his vocabulary, but then also at the same time know how to connect to folks of different stripes. And of course, black folks saw a visual connection to him. And also he gets where a lot of folks came from because he cared to find out. Now, if you grew up not knowing, that's not your fault. But the point is, if you're a politician, if you're trying to connect with people, what you do is you go and connect with them, find out what their life is really like. That's why they made fun of him for being a community organizer. Can't believe he went in the communities and organized and spoke to people and found out what they're really about. Most politicians tell you, this is what American people want, when they've never spoken to any American person that wanted any of that stuff that they said they wanted.
And most of them are barely an American or a person at that point. Ted Cruz, I'm looking at you. Okay, so two additional theories to add on to the most obvious theory, which is almost certainly the case, the social phenomenon that you're describing. One is, I wonder for the speeches, this wouldn't affect the regular people, but I wonder for the speeches, you know how politicians act when they go to the South? How all of a sudden they have accents?
Yeah.
I wonder if some of that might be what we're seeing, is that
totally
they...
True.
They're like maybe when speaking to white Southerners, they do.
They start
it too.
Going y'all and everything. Yeah. Politicians from New York start saying y'all.
Yeah, and the second one, this is what the researcher said. One theory is that this same thing where you downplay your own competence and you speak more simply is how people speak when they're trying to be liked and to be more approachable. Mm-hmm. So there might be some of that. It could be that the Republicans are like, I don't care if you like me, I'm not interested in you. It's probably.
And sadly, it creates more of a racial divide when you don't mean for it to, is the bottom line of this.
Yeah.
It creates more of like your assumptions.
Yeah. So I will continue with what I always do, which is purposefully try hard with vocabulary to make people feel stupid in comparison to me. That's why I'm flipping through vocabulary of the day calendars every morning. Anyway, thank you, JR, for joining us. Always good to have JR Wednesdays.
Don't talk down to me like that.
Was I? I mean, I was being warm, but I was also competent. I'm very smart, so thank you for being on the show. Anyway, thank you for watching the show. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.